Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again.
Unbelievable.
Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake.
A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe in myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome back to episode 248 of the Last Round Podcast. Thank you again for joining us. We apologize for the missed week last week, but we're back this week with all your latest boxing news, reviews, and previews. Jumping straight back into it, fight reviews this past Saturday, the 23rd of September, from the Wembley Arena in London, England on ESPN+. A rematch, a heavyweight matchup from, I think, earlier this year, or was it last year? We'll touch on it in a second. But same matchup, same result. Zhili Zhang, I think I'm pronouncing it right. I think last time I said Zhili Zhang. I think it's Zhili Zhang. Gets the third round knockout over Joe Joyce, who now has the second loss of his career. All two losses in his career so far are to Zhili Zhang. This was for the WBO Interim Heavyweight Championship of the World. Zhang caught him with a nice right hook, essentially. The first fight that they had earlier was a TKO, and this one was a straight knockout. I mean, what did you think? Did you think that a lot of people were obviously surprised in the first fight? Were you on the camp that thought, oh, okay, in the second fight, Joyce is gonna figure it out and they're gonna end up probably having a trilogy later on? What did you think?
No, I just, he had to change too much. You know, everyone seemed to just go to the fact that he came in too light, and if he had a bit more weight about him, you know, his punches would be heavier and he would be able to absorb maybe the punches a little bit better. But it was a lot of it was head movement. You know, there was literally no head movement. He was just a sitting duck. And so far in his career, you know, against, you know, lesser opposition, he's been able to walk through them, you know, like Homer Simpson style. You know, they would just punch him and kind of like wear themselves out by punching him in the face so many times. Pardon me. But yeah, I mean, there was too much to change in a short period of time, I thought, for, you know, him to really, really beat Zhang. And, you know, fortunately, that was the case. You know, Zhang just seemed quicker than him. Zhang just seems to be a bigger version of Joe Joyce. He's like a bigger juggernaut. He's just bigger, wider, absorbs the punches, looks like he's faster than him, does the fundamentals a little bit better than Joe Joyce does. And yeah, you know, all respect for him to getting back in there and, you know, facing him, because, you know, the first time round it was pretty clinical. And like a lot of rematches, the same person won, but they normally do it in better style because they've already beat them. They already have that confidence. And that's exactly what happened here. You know, it was good to see that he was, you know, well afterwards. And, you know, he kind of said, he's like, yeah, I'm going to come back. And you can't really put it down to age. Zhang's actually older than Joe Joyce.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, they both came to the, you know, the pro ranks, you know, at a later part of their career. You know, and so far they've had some good matchups. And, you know, going forward for Zhang, he's got two big fights probably to pick from. You know, if you're looking for some, you know, big fights, do we need either Anthony Joshua or Tyson Fury at the Bird's Nest in China? You know how the Chinese love like those huge sports stars, you know, guys that are really tall, guys that look like an Adonis. Joshua or Fury going over to China, fighting in the Bird's Nest, make it one of those, you know, New Year's Eve fights like they like to do. They always do like a big card, don't they, of martial arts on New Year's Eve. Tends to be a tradition over there. Imagine the pay-per-view numbers for that. It'd be absolutely astronomical, the payday for Tyson or AJ.
Who do you think out of that, those potential scenarios with either of those heavyweights that you mentioned right now, who's the most likely candidate to step into the ring with Zhili Zhang in China, if it happens in China? Because you're right, there's a ton of money there, regardless of whatever you may think about China's economy, politics, they're huge. They got a ton of money. Pacquiao has fought over there, obviously. I think he fought Brandon Rios over there, and I think Algieri too. And there's a big payday. I mean, they're going to Saudi Arabia and the Middle East to get the money. And China, I'm sure, can dish it out as well. And you're right. The Chinese people and the country would love to see one of their own in action, especially in boxing. I mean, when's the last time you've had somebody, you know, of Chinese descent kind of make some sort of an impact in the boxing world? I think it's been a while. And if you can bring Tyson Fury or Anthony Joshua or even like a Deontay Wilder to China, I think that's pretty big. But who do you think out of all those names I just mentioned or any of the more, I guess, financially prominent heavyweights, who would have the most increased chance of actually following through with a bout like that in the country of China?
Tyson Fury now, Zili Zhang, I believe, has options, or Frank Warren has options with Zili Zhang because of that card that they just fought on was obviously a Frank Warren card. So, you know, I think he has a couple of fight options with him, so that fight would be easy to make. We know Tyson Fury loves to have big, easy paydays, you know, when he fought, like, you know, Chisora, he's obviously fighting Ngannou, which is pretty much an exhibition. So he could quickly turn that around, I guess, you know, if they wanted to do that on New Year's Eve and fight someone like Zili Zhang, because, you know, what is China, like 2 billion population, something like that? So, you know,
it's
like
huge, a
well-priced pay-per-view over there could make you an ungodly amount of money. And they just love huge sports stars. You remember, like, Bob Sapp went over there and used to fight in combat sports, you know, like all the bodybuilders. If you watch those documentaries, they go over there. They're looked at like gods because they just love like huge, muscular, you know, stars. So, you know, having someone like Zhang, who is, you know, one of their own, I'm sure he can make a crazy amount of money going in there with someone like a global superstar like AJ or Tyson Fury.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a ton of money on the table. Like you said, sometimes foreign athletes who go over there, they make a second career. You mentioned those names. There's another name in the NBA here in the United States. He's retired now, but he was a basketball player. His name was Stephon Marbury. He had a great career in the United States playing for different teams for, I don't know, over a decade or more or something like that. But then the business side and, you know, the interest from teams wasn't there at one point. So he went to China to play basketball over there. And he had like a second wind in his career over there, playing like another 8 years and winning multiple, I guess, their world championships in their country for their basketball league. And I think he still goes over there. He still like works over there in some form, but you're right. There's a ton of money and, you know, it's a big business. It's what, I mean, the country's essentially, especially in population, it's bigger than the United States, you know, and they have a ton of money. Like Saudi Arabia is also there making, you know, their offers for all that, the United Arab Emirates. But yeah, I think Zili Zhang is ready for, I mean, whether he's ready or not, I mean, based on these two performances against Joe Joyce, it obviously looks like he's definitely ready or at least deserving for a big matchup with one of the bigger heavyweights, don't you think? Or do you think he hasn't really, because he's beaten Joe Joyce, he hasn't really deserved, I guess, that next level against those guys?
I think he deserves it, you know, just the fact that he's got himself into that position. You know, he holds the WBO interim. In my opinion, he hasn't actually lost. I thought he beat Hergovich, you know, but Hergovich, I think, went into that fight as the favorite, and the judges, you know, kind of gave that to him. I thought Zili Zhang won that fight, so he really should be 27, you know, 0.
And
he would have had another good name on his ledger, you know, in Joe Joyce and also, you know, Hergovich. So, you know, he's in there. He's obviously mandatory now for Usyk, but if you're him, you'd probably turn around and be like, you know, you'd really want to fight, you know, the two that we've mentioned in China, just because, you know, he's 40 years old. Huge payday for him. You know, you've got to try to cash out at some point, right?
Do you think that Frank Warren would make a rematch between Joe Joyce and Daniel Dubois? Did they fight once or twice?
Twice. This was the rematch from, I don't know, four, months ago, 5 months ago or something?
No. I'm talking about did Joe Joyce and Daniel Dubois fight once or twice?
Oh, sorry. Just the once.
Just the once, right? Do you think Frank Warren is maybe considering now, after especially after having Joyce lose back-to-back here, maybe he puts him against Daniel Dubois again? And because Dubois, you're like, oh, okay, well, they both suffer some losses. Let's put them against each other again.
I don't know, because he seemed a little bit down on Joe Joyce after the fight. I think he was telling him to retire. I don't know. Maybe he's looking at, you know, the minimum purse that he has to pay Joe Joyce, and he's thinking to himself, well, he's just taking two back-to-back pretty convincing losses. I don't really want to put him on a card because, you know, is he going to generate that much money? But it's good for Daniel Dubois, you know, if he's going to go on the rise. What's one thing that all fighters like to do? They'd like to go back and obviously revenge their losses. And so far, that's Dubois' only loss, and it could be a good time for him to jump on it, you know, jump on Joe when, you know, his confidence is down and stuff like that. It's kind of showing that maybe there is, you know, a way to beat him, because at the time when Dubois was fighting him and up until recently, he looked unstoppable. You know, we were calling him the juggernaut because he was just walking through everyone's punches, you know, comically at times, you know, walking through punches. So, yeah, you know, Frank Warren did seem down on him, but, you know, if I was Dubois, maybe it's a good time, you know, to get in there, because the heavyweight division is a little bit stagnant, right? Because, you know, like, everyone's kind of waiting for Usyk and, you know, waiting for Tyson Fury. And, you know, unfortunately, they're not fighting each other yet. So, you know, you haven't got all the time in the world. You know, if you look back at careers of people like Amir Khan, who waited several years, you know, to get that fight with Floyd Mayweather that never materialized. You know, sometimes it does. Sometimes you can wait and you get the fight that you want. Like Caleb Plant kind of waited for Canelo, right, and got it. But you just don't know what's around the corner. So you're better off really just to fight and take purses whilst they're there.
No, exactly. Exactly, yeah. And do you think Frank Warren is considering, and how realistic do you think it could be that he tries to make a Daniel Dubois and Zhele Zhang in the future now? Maybe next, and sometime next year. I mean, because Dubois is a Frank Warren fighter, right? He still is.
Yeah. I mean, if I was Frank, I would you'd go for the Fury Zhang first, because you've got both of them. You're going to get a slice of the pie. But then after that, yeah, because, you know, Zhang is probably rated high in the WBO. You know, during that period, you could have Dubois come back. Obviously, you just lost to Usyk. Have a little comeback fight. Get a win on the ledger, and then turn around and, you know, you could fight, you know, Zhang after Zhang loses to Fury, because I think, you know, I think Tyson Fury probably boxes his ears off, right? He's a little bit too stagnant and too big to face someone like a Tyson Fury with the high boxing IQ that he's got. So I'm sure Tyson was absolutely loving it, that the fact that Zhang managed to beat Joe Joyce for a second time.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. I didn't follow any social media postings that he put or anything, but I do wonder if he put anything out there in reaction.
Dollar signs. If I was him, I would be putting dollar signs.
And in the flag of China.
Right.
You never know. You never know. Also on the card, Anthony Yard gets the second round KO over Jorge Silva, who takes the ninth loss of his career, one away from double-digit losses in his professional career. The 32-year-old Yard is now 24-3 with 23 knockouts. But Silva, if it's any worth mentioning, was 40 years old. He's been around a while. I mean, it's good that Yard got the win. Obviously, you know, it's better than obviously taking a loss. But how do you rate this performance, and how do you rate this this ultimate victory?
The original fight for Yard, if I remember rightly, was supposed to be Ricky Summers. Ricky Summers ended up, you know, dropping out last minute with an injury. And Yard just kind of said to Frank Warren, he's like, that he didn't want to move to a later fight later in the year because he'd done a camp. And he's like, you know, I want to get back out after my loss. You know, so they at the last minute, you know, Jorge Silva managed to step in, and it kind of is what it is. I mean, it got to the point where, you know, I'm a member of a few forums and a few groups on Facebook. And some of them are like matchmaking Facebooks. And there was a matchmaker from Frank Warren actually posted.
Oh, wow.
On there. And I think the purse was like $50,000.
Oh, wow.
That's how desperate they were fight week to find someone to step in. So, you know, when you're looking at stuff like that, it was a two-round knockout win for, you know, Yard. But, you know, get him back in the groove, right? And hopefully from what he said, we'll see him in there with, you know, some British fighters, because that weight division is stacked in the UK. So, you know, selfishly, you know, we've got people like, you know, Dan Aziz, Buatsi, Anthony Yard, you know, and several others. So I think it's about time they all faced each other, you know, because it's going to be big paydays. They can have round robins, and, you know, those big British fights always do good numbers for TV.
And also this past weekend from the Caribe Royale Orlando, I think I said, or Caribe, in Florida, Orlando, Florida, on DAZN, Richardson Hitchens remains undefeated at 17-0 with 12-round unanimous decision win over Jose Zepeda, who takes the fourth loss of his career. Hitchens won by scores of 120-108 twice and 119-109. I was telling you before we came on air that I was really surprised about this decision, and how Zepeda was just essentially shut out throughout this fight, because Zepeda's been in competitive fights. He's been in there with some of the best fighters at 140 pounds, and Richardson Hitchens completely shut down his game. So give me a reaction on the performance of Hitchens, and do you think this was more Hitchens just being supremely more talented than Jose Zepeda, or just Zepeda's, you know, the clock's just catching up. Father Time's just catching up on Zepeda, especially through all the wars that he's been through.
The performance was, I mean, it has some like negatives and some positives. The performance in terms of just getting a win, outstanding. There's not really much you can say. He probably won every single round, essentially. But for somebody that's going to get wins and generate, you know, enough money and enough interest, Richardson Hitchens isn't going to do that, unfortunately. You know, he has that very kind of, it's like, he just kind of like nullifies what the opponent's going to do. And then, you know, when Zepeda was able to actually get into range, you know, he would clinch him and stuff like that. And he would just never, every time Zepeda tried to, you know, come forward, he would just eating jabs and never let him get set. You know, we'd kind of like tie him up, hug him, get him in like a little headlock and stuff like that. And, you know, Chris Young constantly kind of early on showed that he wasn't going to allow any of that and kept breaking him. So Zepeda was kind of essentially lost because he couldn't get on the inside and get any work done. So, you know, for Hitchens, it's good. He's probably going to win a lot of fights and stuff like that with that style, but I think he's going to bore the crowds. And that's the problem that he's going to have. You know, he's kind of a more boring version of like Devin Haney. Someone who has that similar style, but actually is exciting to watch, is Shakur. Because Shakur has a very, you know, I'll hit you, you don't hit me style, but he goes for knockouts. You know, he seems to be a lot like more heavy-handed, whereas Hitchens just kind of has that amateur, like gets in, hits you, gets out with style, nullifies everything that you're trying to do, high boxing IQ, but it's just not good for TV. It's just not good to watch. It's because you come in, it's a gladiatorial sport. You want knockouts. And unfortunately, you know, Hitchens doesn't give you that. And maybe he just doesn't have the power, or maybe it's just not, you know, not his style. You know, maybe eventually he might be able to, you know, change it up and, you know, sit down on his punches a little more, you know, something like Tyson Fury did, obviously, at this end of his career, but I doubt it.
Do you think that the ideal, I don't want to say finish line, but the ideal pathway here for Eddie Hearn and Matchroom and DAZN is to make a Hitchens and Devin Haney at 140? I mean, since Devin Haney now essentially, we've seen all these reports that he's vacated some titles at 135 or something, and he's just going to, you know, the Prograde fight is supposedly still being negotiated, but that hasn't materialized or finalized. Do you think that, I mean, obviously I'm sure they've thought about it. Eddie Hearn's thought about it. DAZN has thought about it. But when would you think ideally that Eddie Hearn and DAZN would want to make a Hitchens versus Haney at 140 pounds? Next year? Or is that too early? Maybe 2 years down the line?
Would you want to make it?
Well, that's besides the point. It's more just to say, like, just to have them have opponents for each other. You know, I mean you're right. In terms of entertainment for the viewer,
it'd be terrible.
Yeah, it would be more of a technical boxing matchup. But, yeah, absolutely. But you know, I who could DAZN and Eddie Hearn offer to Devin Haney at 140 right now. I mean, 140 essentially, you know, 140 is kind of spread out across different, you know, you got Teofimo at ESPN. You got, I mean, I guess if you want to still count Josh Taylor, even though he's probably going to be 147, you know, Tank Davis, like even Shakur, but you know, they're all kind of spread out. So they're, the zone and Matchroom and Eddie Hearn are going to need options for somebody like Devin Haney, especially because he's coming up as, you know, the undisputed champion from the weight below to fight at 140. And you also got Prograis there too, as well. You know, I mean, what's the pathway here for somebody like Hitchens for the zone and Matchroom?
Kind of going back to the, you know, the first thing you kind of mentioned. I mean, Regis Prograis and Devin Haney, I believe, is going to get announced this week. I saw some interviews with Frank Smith and Eddie Hearn, and you know that's going to be in San Francisco, like we spoke about.
I know, because I know we talked about that a couple weeks ago about San Francisco, but we hadn't heard anything since. It was just reports. Does it seem like it's going to get finalized, and or what are we looking at here?
From what Frank Smith and Eddie said in the interviews I watched from the weekend, they said this week. So I would imagine Monday, I'm sure they'll probably let the weekend get out the way. And then Monday they'll put out, you know, like a poster, and then, you know, they'll start like all the media stuff, I would imagine, some point this week. But I mean, I personally wouldn't put, you know, Hitchens in with Devin Haney, just because very similar fighters. I don't think the fight would be too good. And, you know, they're not super popular characters. So like, you know, Devin Haney, from what we all hear, he commands a pretty high purse. And, you know, are you going to get that back? You know, Richards and Hitchens is a pretty much unknown, you know. He headlined this fight. I don't know. He didn't do great numbers, I don't think, in Florida. It was a very small ballroom event by the look of it. So, you know, I think they need to be, you know, matched separately. Montana Love could be somebody, you know, if he's still,
oh, that's right, Max, yeah,
if he's still with Matchroom, because, you know, they had that fight with Steve Spark where he threw him out the ring and then he got disqualified, if you remember.
That's crazy.
You know, so you could stick Hitchens in with someone like Montana Love, maybe Steve Spark, if they've still got options with him. Because I still think he needs to be, you know, built a little bit before sticking him in with somebody like a Teofimo Lopez, a Regis Prograis, a Devin Haney. You know, try to get him, you know, more popular, you know, hopefully stick him in there with the right opponents, maybe someone that they could actually, you know, take out, whether it been, you know, a TKO just from a flurry of punches, because he doesn't seem to be like a, you know, a one punch knockout artist. So just, you know, you got to draw more attention to him. I still think there's some building to do before we stick him in there with someone like a Devin Haney, because he's got the skills, he's got the boxing IQ. He's just, you know, he's just not built yet.
And then for Zepeda, and you know, during this fight between Hitchens and Zepeda, there was a clash of heads in the 10th round when Hitchens missed with the forearm block. So Zepeda got pretty much the negative side of that contact between the heads as he started bleeding pretty bad, especially in the final few rounds. For Zepeda, you know, he's been with Top Rank, ESPN. He fought, was it Prograis, right, and here in LA at the StubHub with that random promoter?
Yeah, with Marv Nation.
Right, Marv Nation, yeah. You know, he's kind of been all over the place now. I mean, what are we looking at Zepeda here? You know, is Golden Boy going to sneak in and offer Zepeda maybe some fights? Maybe for Ryan Garcia, or, you know, maybe even Jojo Diaz at 140, or William Zepeda. I mean, Zepeda versus Zepeda? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great shout, to be honest with you. It looks like, you know, Zepeda's 34 now. He's had, you know, a whole host of fights. He's, I think he's like, what, 30, maybe even 40 fights now. So, you know, he could end up being kind of used like Jose Pedraza. He's had, what, 41 fights now?
Right.
So, you know, I could see him, you know, kind of just sticking around for a few more paydays and essentially becoming like a gatekeeper, you know, fighting some of these guys who were up and coming. I suppose it just really depends, you know, something that we can't see, you know, how much heart does he have left? You know, has he made enough money where he doesn't need it anymore? Or, you know, does he still need a few more, you know, paydays just to make sure that he's, you know, him and his family are going to be right? So We'll see. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And also on the card, Jessica McCaskill gets the split decision, fights to a split decision draw against Sandy Ryan. This was for the IBO, WBA, WBC, and WBO welterweight titles. The scores were 95-95 twice, 94-96, and 97-93. Obviously, the last two scores were split between the competitors. I mean, I saw some clips of this fight. It wasn't really, you know, in-your-face action. What'd you think?
In terms of the judges' scorecards, absolutely awful, absolutely atrocious, ridiculous. How on earth you had McCaskill winning 97-93 should be looked at, because I thought McCaskill was absolutely awful. Absolutely awful. She's literally just... like, if she was a man, she'd be like a low level, super low level, like club fighter. Just her technique is awful. She has low hands constantly. She didn't look like she came in shape. Just absolutely awful. I thought Sandy Ryan pretty much won eight rounds. It was convincing. You could see. I'm trying to think who was on the the broadcast now. Mora, Chris Mannix, Corey Erdman, and there was a fighter who was on there. Oh, Sonny Edwards. Sonny Edwards was on there. And all of them said, you know, last round, pretty much, they were like, yeah, you know, Sandy Ryan's won, blah, 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 kind of talking about what's going to come next. And then the scorecards came out and everybody said it. Even McCaskill looked shocked in the in-ring interview afterwards.
Right.
That she, when they went up to her, she didn't even say, oh, yeah, I won. Yeah, I won. She's like, yeah, no, I thought it was close. And, you know, maybe like one round or something like that. So yeah, it just goes to show, you know, they need to.
Would you really think, as a fighter, if you were a fighter, do you think it's better for them to admit that they lost, even if it was a draw, or you know, what do you think it's better for their reputation and their stock as a fighter going forward? What do you think? Should they admit that they lost, even if it was a draw or whatever?
If it's close by like a round, you know, you can convince yourself and maybe convince other people, but. That wasn't even close. Like, I know the scorecard showed it, but it was absolutely not close at all. And if you get beat like that, you're better off just saying it, because you're not going to fool the people that are watching, you know? Because at the end of the day, it's a draw. That's not going to change. They're not going to turn around because you've said, like, yeah, I lost. You know, I didn't deserve to win the belts today. I think you'd probably gather more fans by that, because how unusual that would be. I think people would be like, you know what, I like that. I like the fact that he was honest about that. Or, you know, she was honest about that, because we're talking about Jessica McCaskill. You know, it's a nice change of pace, isn't it, to have someone be honest like that and say. But, yeah, I mean, that needs to be looked at. The scorecards for that fight were pretty bad. And then, obviously, the next one with the Conor Benn card, one of those scorecards was pretty bad as well. So, yeah, boxing for you.
Like you just touched on, Conor Benn makes his return to the ring, which was pretty major news over this past weekend. Probably, at least in the boxing world, probably the most talked about news over the last couple of days. Conor Benn, as I mentioned, makes his return ever since testing positive for banned substances in his fight against Chris Eubank. There wasn't a fight, and hit the scheduled fight against Chris Eubank Jr. This was the first time that Conor Benn has been licensed in any territory, I think, in the world since that situation. There was definitely some vocal and visible criticism in regards to if Conor Benn should be fighting or not. I guess there's some confusion or some discrepancies in terms of if the British Board of Boxing Control has essentially cleared Conor Benn or not. In their investigation regarding the testing, I saw some interviews where Eddie Hearn said that he was. I guess it just depends on the explanation. So before we actually, you know, get your reaction on his performance. What was your reaction when you saw that Conor Benn was coming on this card? Do you think it was planned already, and they just kind of slid it in there to try to avoid the long weeks PR for this leading up to this event? Or do you think it was really, hey, we need somebody to step in, whatever, let's just throw Conor Benn in there?
Yeah, I believe it was probably planned. I assume they were just waiting for the the blessing of the Florida Commission. From what Eddie and people were saying, it looks like they had to reach out to the British Board of Boxing just to make sure that, you know, he wasn't still suspended. And then obviously, you know, yeah, it found out that he wasn't. And obviously they just slid him in, obviously, depending on whether they could find an opponent in time. And like you said, I'm sure, you know, even if they had the approval weeks in advance, they didn't want 2 weeks of interviews about Conor Benn, like overshadowing the whole event. I think it was announced like Monday or Tuesday. So then they had to put up with, you know, 4 or 5 days worth of Conor Benn questions, which, you know, I kind of get. But then looking at it, you know, should he have been there? No, really, with, you know, it looks like the British Board of Boxing are going to appeal, you know, that fact. But it's just funny because, you know, I was kind of like looking into it, you know, for the podcast and, you know, just being intrigued, obviously, in boxing that, you know, the way they got around it was, you know, they weren't denying that he tested positive. They were just saying to the British Board of Boxing, you can't ban him because it was a VADA test. And your rules state that you don't recognize VADA tests. So that was pretty much their legal battle that they went around. So the British Board of Boxing had to essentially be like, okay, no, that, you know, that's fair enough. It's not, that's not your jurisdiction. You know, it wasn't a UCAD test, which is what you use, which is funny because then you're kind of like, well, okay, like what's the point in paying for VADA if they test positive under VADA and then you're going to claim that you can't ban them? What's the point in having VADA?
That is a fair question to ask. And do you think ever since this situation has been unfolding and, you know, Matchroom and Conor Benn's team essentially challenging the legality of any potential ban, do you think that would cause the British Boxing Board of Control to amend their, you know, their rules and regulations to include VADA? Like, hey, they're kind of right. We don't have this listed. We have UCAD listed. We should include VADA, all the major players who would potentially be included in any fights. Do you think this is going to cause a ripple effect to make that change?
I mean, common sense would say yes, right? So I would hope so, but boxing is such a weird sport with stuff that happens. You would think that they would add it immediately, you know? Maybe the rules had just been written that long ago and nobody had really looked at it and amended it, that it had kind of just gone like overlooked, you know, where they didn't think like, oh, crap, we've never actually added that in there. You know, so far, no one's ever challenged it, so they've never had to change it. But, you know, hopefully, you know, after this event and this, you know, kind of atrocity of, you know, what it's, you know, it's dragged on for, what, 18 months? And then essentially...
A long time.
Yeah, I mean, and if you look at it in a weird way, that he kind of had an 18-month ban, right? Because of the fact that, you know, he hasn't been able to fight and, you know, he's only just got back in. So, you know, if anything does come around, it's going to be the same as the Tyson Fury one where they'll just say, okay, like 18 months, but it's backdated to, you know, when you tested positive, and then that's all that's going to happen now, you know, because he's already been out. He's already essentially served some type of ban, I guess. But then it's just funny that, you know, Eddie does that and then, was it like last week or 2 weeks ago, he then says that every single Matchroom card is now going to have VADA. And it's going to be like every single person who fights in it is going to be under VADA. And I think he said it's going to cost him around $500,000, I think, per event.
Oof, that's a lot.
Something like that. But
VADA must be really happy about that financially.
But it's like, on one hand, that I mean, that's really good. You know, that's what we've all wanted in the sport for the longest time. But then you've just circumvented their rules in the UK by saying, hey, you don't recognize VADA, you can't ban them. So it's like, well, what's the point in you paying if someone tests positive and you're just going to get a legal team and go around it? And we all know why. Conor Benn generates a lot of money, you know, the amount of money that they lost in, I think it was $1 million or something, you know, in organizing the Conor Benn Eubank Jr. fight the first time and then it falling through.
Right.
So yeah, it's, you know, it's boxing for you, you know, we keep saying it, you know, but like, it's just such a, it's the Wild West.
And what do you think are the, any potential, I guess, after effects of Conor Benn? You know, obviously Florida gave the green light on them. So, you know, whether Florida deserves criticism or not, you know, that's up for debate. I don't know, who knows, but, he obviously fought in the state of Florida in the United States. Would California, would Nevada, would they clear him? You know, how would they, what do you think?
They have to, as far as I know. If he's not serving a ban, there's like a, what was it? You can appeal like the right to work or something like that. Essentially, like if he's not suspended for something and he was found not guilty, you can't stop him from working.
Right.
There's some type of law that Eddie briefly mentioned it in some type of interview. I think if, because they were talking about, you know, if Conor Benn decides to fight, you know, Chris Eubank Jr. in the UK and the British Board of Boxing tried to turn down his license, he mentioned something about there's like a law of, you know, with right to work. You can't just refuse that on like no grounds, because essentially he won the case. So they can't stop him from working. So I think that would be similar, you know, if they decided to hold that huge fight in California for some random reason, you know, he essentially won the case, right? You can't stop him from working. You can't stop him from earning a living just on, you know, something that you're like, oh, well, I think you're guilty, but so what? You know, I was found not guilty. It doesn't matter what you think, you know,
right.
It needs to be a valid reason to stop him from getting, you know, a visa or a license as such. So, you know, as much as we probably all think that he got caught and, you know, he's managed to get around it, it's the system. And if anything comes out with this, hopefully we get a better testing system.
Do you think it's more that the British Boxing Board of Control, you know, I don't really think, I find it hard to believe that they were unaware or oblivious to not having VADA within their internal rules and regulations and bylaws. I find that hard to believe. I feel like you said, they might have known, but they just said, they thought or assumed, oh, well, no, nothing's happened yet. You know, why change anything if it's not broken? You know, we haven't had to cross that bridge yet. So why are we going to create something if we haven't had the situation presented to us? Because that is strange. You know, did they look at it more like, well, we have the utmost confidence in UCAD because, you know, it's UK based and all that. That's, you know, the testing body for obviously the United Kingdom. Did they look at it maybe like, well, if VADA is included as well, and UCAD is obviously going to be there when it's a fight over here, they should find the same thing, you know, if they're using similar techniques. Do you think that maybe they looked at it like that, or you think it was just laziness and they thought, oh, well, why adapt? Why make any adaptive changes if we haven't had to yet?
Yeah, I think it's just like, you know, when people make case law, you know, it'd never been challenged. You know, they probably just said, oh, well, you know, it's written like that, but we mean, you know, everyone. We mean VADA, we mean WADA, we mean UKAD. But Eddie Hearn's got deep pockets and, you know, good legal team. They said, yeah, but we're taking that verbatim. You know, you're right. Saying that, but that's not what it says. I'm sure it's something along those lines, you know, where people challenge stuff and make case law, you know, for the rest of time. I'm sure that's what it is. It's like, you know, going forward, we're going to have, you know, Conor Benn case law because, you know, he challenged it and he won. And like I said, if that's anything comes out of this, it's hopefully we just have, you know, a better system, you know, going forward where, you know, people are going to get tested more. They're going to, we're going to get more positive tests and stuff like that to begin with. You know, and eventually, you know, we'll hopefully have a cleanish sport. But, you know, these mad scientists are always ahead of the game, you know, they're always ahead of the curve. And, you know, the guys who have deep pockets and stuff like that, they can kind of negate the rules, right? You know, when someone just randomly goes for a training camp in the Philippines or somewhere mad, knowing that VADA probably don't have the money to fly out there and, you know, come and test them.
So do you think that Conor Benn now doing this and being licensed in Florida and fighting this in Florida this past weekend, you know, because it's like so vague and, you know, that he did win the case and then, you know, the interpretation of the rules and regulations over there in the UK in regards to the situation, do you think that the British Boxing Board of Control is going to do everything in their power to try to keep him from fighting on UK soil again? Or do you think that Eddie Hearn and Matchroom and Conor Benn's team are going to challenge them to try to make a fight? Because, I mean, you would think that DAZN and Eddie Hearn are still highly interested in, especially because Eubank just, well, actually he won, but do you think they're still interested in making that Eubank matchup?
100%. It's the biggest fight for both of them. You know, it's a huge fight for Conor Benn. in terms of purse. Same for Chris Eubank Jr. And I'm sure that brings the most money to Matchroom as well. Outside of like a Fury AJ fight, I couldn't really think of a British matchup that would be as big off the top of my head.
Fight.
Yeah, you know, it's just the name, right? You know, because you've got that generational thing from the, you know, from the fathers to them. And then they're, you know, characters themselves. You know, you've got Chris Eubank Jr. that has that kind of like arrogance, confidence. And then you have, you know, Conor Benn, who's kind of always walks around with like 100%, you know, like he's constantly pissed off and he's about to snap at any minute. So I'm sure the, you know, the press conferences and stuff like that leading up to it will be insane. And I think, didn't the first fight, like, it was set for Manchester and it sold out like on the first day, like in a couple of hours or something like that.
Quick. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, due to all of that, like, why would you not, you know, not try to make it? And, you know, the British body boxing, I'm sure they're not happy with it, but I don't think they can stop him, essentially. I think, you know, they don't have a lot of money, so they can't just keep appealing and taking it to court because it must be costing them a lot of money.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly it. And they're obviously the public agency over there, right? So...
Yeah, I mean, they don't have, it'd be like California. The California, you know, is, they don't have deep pockets and they have the most fights in the whole of the US, you know, and they're not, you know, they're not swimming in money.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, this is going to be very interesting to see. And then, you know, focusing on the actual fight that he had, he did go the full 10 rounds with his opponent, Rodolfo Orozco. Conor Benn did win by scores of 99-91 twice and 96-94. Is that something we should look into? Should we analyze that or should we just kind of overlook it and make, do you look at it more as Conor Benn trying to get in there just to get some rounds? What do you think?
I mean, it's hard to tell because I'm sure that you don't know, neither of us know that much about Orozco, but he definitely has a flipping chin on him. I'll give him that, you know, because he caught him flush a few times. And he kind of just walked forward, and he made it into a really good fight. It was a really good 10 rounds to watch, just because Orozco just never really kind of backed down and just kept coming and coming and put on a really good performance. It's one of those ones where, you know, you come in as the underdog and you give a good performance. And I think Matchroom openly said that, you know, they were, you know, impressed by him, and he'd definitely be coming back on one of their Matchroom Mexico shows, which is good for him. If anything, you know, going 10 rounds may give some of the people, you know, confidence that they can get in there with Conor Benn. They're like, oh, you know what? You only fucking knock these guys out, like Algieri and Van Herden, because he was on steroids. You know, I'll fight him now. Now that he's not on there, he's not the same animal. But you know, we'll see. You know, he's, I would imagine by the end of the year, start of maybe 2024. You know, January time, I'm sure we'll see him in there with Chris Eubank Jr. It's just, is it with Matchroom? Is it going to be with, you know, boxer? Is it going to be in England or is it going to be in Saudi?
You know how pissed off the UK fan base would be if that fight, a Ben Eubank fight, wasn't in on British soil, UK soil?
That's exactly the card that Eddie's going to play. Going forward, I'm sure that's all we'll hear on like IFL TV, Boxing Social. He's just going to use that against Robert Smith and the British Board of Boxing. We want to put it in England, but the border boxing and it's just going to use that against them and have everybody against them.
Yeah, yeah. A PR man, a PR spin.
He's the PR master. Uncle Eddie's a PR master.
That is ridiculous. Also on the card, Austin Amo Williams returns and remains undefeated at 15-0 with a 10-round unanimous decision win over Steve Rolls, who takes the third loss of his career. This was for the IBF North American middleweight title. Obviously Rolls has been in there with like Triple G and I think Berlanga was in there with Berlanga at one point. I feel like Austin Williams we haven't seen him in a while. Am I wrong, or maybe I'm just overlooking it? What's going on here?
He's been on a couple of Eddie shows, but not really in there with anybody of note, because if you remember, he had that, you know, the mental health, where he stepped away from the ring for a period of time, and then he came back. And just have a look. He was out at the start of this year, April, against River Wilson Bent, where he won by 8th round TKO. And then he was out three times, was it 4 times last year against you know, just lower level kind of opponents, nobody of real note. But this was probably a good step up for him. I wasn't overly impressed, though. You know, I thought, and I saw the same on Twitter. People were like, you know what, like, they're kind of pushing Amal Williams on us, and now he's pretty highly ranked. But I don't see it. I don't see him really beating anybody at middleweight. I think he's still got a long way to go.
Right.
But he's super confident. You know, in the interviews afterwards, he said he's ready to step in there now. So,
do you think he's ready?
No, I mean, I don't think so. Especially against, you know, some of the, is it Ahmed, what's he called? I can't pronounce his name. Zanibek. I'll just say his first name.
Zanibek. Yeah,
Zanibek. Yeah. I think he would have him twisting and turning, and I think he would deal with Amal Williams pretty easily. And I know that he's going in there coming up soon against Vincenzo. Is it Gulleretti? Is that how you pronounce it, from Germany? I know that Zanibek and those two are fighting each other, so that should be a decent fight. I don't know. Would you stick him in there with someone like a Liam Smith? You know,
maybe. But Smith, just, you know, even though he lost in his last bout against Eubank, I feel like Smith still, you know, he's still dangerous. So, but yeah, why not? Why not?
If I was Matrim, I would have him in there with Michael Zarafa. He's still surprisingly highly ranked from Australia, not much punching power. And Michael Zarafa, you know, he's been in there with some names. He's been in there with Kell Brook, Jeff Horn. So you kind of get that, you take that star power, right? You know, like, oh, okay, like, I recognize that guy. I remember him fighting Kell Brook. So
right.
I think that would be someone of note that Amo could probably beat, and you're still climbing the rankings.
I can see that. Yeah, I can agree with that suggestion of an opponent. Moving on to fight previews. This upcoming Saturday, the 30th of September, from the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas, Nevada, on Showtime pay-per-view, the biggest draw in boxing, I think it's still safe to say, returns to the ring. Saul Canelo Alvarez, 59-2-2, goes up against Jermell Charlo, 35-1-1. This is for the undisputed super middleweight titles of the world. At least until that first bell rings, they are able to use the titles of undisputed champion versus undisputed champion for both of them. Because when that bell does ring, Jermell Charlo is undisputed right now at 154. Canelo has been undisputed at 168 for a while now. But Charlo will be losing, I believe. Is it the WBO or is it the IBF? It's WBO, right?
Yeah.
The WBO has already announced that when that bell rings for this fight this Saturday in Las Vegas on Showtime pay-per-view, that Charlo will be stripped of that title, of the WBO 154 title. So I guess up until that bell rings, as I mentioned, it is undisputed. But when that bell rings again, or when that fight finishes one way or another, the undisputed title will not be there any longer. And when this was announced, everybody was, you know, shocked. We thought it was going to be Jermall Charlo, which is the brother who fights at 160 pounds. We thought he would move up to 168 to fight Canelo. Reportedly, I guess that was the original plan from what we've seen in reports, but one reason or another happened, and Jermall Charlo could not be the opponent. So his lighter brother in weight stepped in, I guess, reportedly, and is moving up, in a sense, 14 pounds to fight the king of boxing, I guess, you know, and Canelo Alvarez. What do you think? What do you think about this matchup? You know, are we going to see a more competitive fight than we think? Is the weight that Jermell Charlo going up, is it just going to be too much against somebody with the technique and the experience and the talent of Canelo Alvarez? What do you think?
When you saw them in the face-off, wasn't much difference, really, because Canelo, I think we forget, has always just been kind of doing the impossible, you know, and just always being the smaller guy, and he was always just fighting the bigger guys, you know, moving up to, you know, 160, 168, or, you know, going up to 175, you know, because he kept winning. I think we just kind of forgot, you know, that he was constantly going in there, like, against all odds. You know, he was always the shorter, you know, he's always stocky and strong, but he was always the shorter guy, you know, naturally smaller in terms of weight as well. But when you saw these guys facing off, I didn't think Charlo was, you know, he wasn't, didn't look that look smaller. He wasn't like as stocky, you know, wasn't as thick as Canelo, but I'm assuming it just means it's going to be easier for him to do the weight cut. You know, he's not going to have to take off all that weight before he gets in there with him. I think it's a good matchup. You know, I think, you know, the 154, Jermell Charlo is a good fighter. He's been in there with some, you know, really good opponents, but this is going to be a, you know, a bit of a test for him, you know, not just moving up 14 pounds. You're moving up 14 pounds and fighting probably one of the greatest fighters of the last, what, 5 years, something like that, you know.
Decade, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, probably the last 5 to 10 years. He's, I think this will kind of show us, you know, is Canelo kind of on the slide right now? Because the last few times he's got in there, you know, when he's facing like people like Bivol, Ryder, you know, people were saying, you know, he's on the slide, you know, he's not as good, thinking he should have taken John Ryder out. But then also, you know, losing to Bivol essentially pretty easily, which kind of
Bivol was always I mean, regardless, you're right, but like Bivol was always a threat. It's just he wasn't known to people, but he was always a threat.
Yeah. So I think this will show us. I think Canelo will win. I think he'll eventually get to him and stop him. I think we'll see a similar performance to when Canelo fought Callum Smith. I think he'll just keep punching him, and like it'll be all over the body though. You know, I don't think he'll just go headhunting. I think he'll go in there. He'll try to negate him by like the old Duran style, just hitting him, you know, on the side, hitting him on the shoulder, hitting him on the bicep and stuff like that. Literally just kind of like beating him down. And I think eventually, I think he'll end up stopping him in one of the late rounds.
You think so?
Think so, yeah. I think Canelo's just, I just think he's that good still. I don't think he's on the slide. I thought when he fought John Ryder's just a big, tough guy. And then, like you said, I think people that know boxing know that the losing to Bivol wasn't that bad. You know, Bivol can box. Bivol was the bigger, more naturally sized guy. And he just came in with somebody that's got a high boxing IQ. People forget that Bivol was a high decorated amateur.
Yeah.
It's just that he was in that
talented
who wants him category as a pro, because he was super, super good, but didn't bring a lot of money and a lot of belts to the table. So nobody ever wanted to face him. So he wasn't seen by your casual fans.
How likely do you think it that Jermell Charlo tries to get into a brawl with Canelo? Because we've seen Charlo get into brawls in his, you know, past fights. And I think it's safe to say that if you had to pick which one of the brothers of the Charlo brothers was the more talented, has had the more competitive and experienced fights, it's probably Jermell Charlo, who's obviously in this fight. And he's, you know, he's proven it with the undisputed titles at 154 and all that. But I mean, I don't know why, but I'm thinking, and I could be wrong. That's why I'm asking this question. If Charlo's going to try to get into a brawl with Canelo, but I kind of have this feeling that it might end up kind of being like a Caleb Plant, Canelo Alvarez fight, where Caleb Plant was fighting pretty decently in terms of technique and everything up until he got caught and he got knocked out and the fight was over. Am I misjudging this in terms of thinking about it like that? Or what do you think?
See, I think you've got to. With Canelo being the smaller, probably stockier, and maybe even heavier guy, naturally stronger, I think you've got to box him like Bivol did. Bivol kind of showed people like a path to do it, you know? Box him from the outside.
Charlo's not a Bivol, though. He doesn't have that technique. he's good. I'm not saying he's not good. He's a great fighter, but Charlo and Bivol are not the same fighter. They're not the same. I mean, obviously, I'm sure they're looking at tape of Bivol, and obviously, you know, that makes sense. But like you touched on earlier, Canelo's most likely going to go to what he's been doing the last couple fights, where he hits him on the bicep, hits him on the leg or whatever to try to slow them down all over their body. Doing that to Bivol, who was the bigger fighter, who was fighting at 175 pounds, Bivol was able to absorb that. But even in the post fight, and in interviews, Bivol said, like, oh, no, he's like, my arm, like, it hurts. Like, but Bivol was able to take it because of his size and his strength. Do you think Charlo is going to be able to take those?
No, that's why I don't think that that would be a good decision for him to try to stand and bang with him. I think that Canelo's just, because he's been fighting at 168 and 175, I think he's just naturally now the bigger, stronger, sturdier type of guy. So I don't think, you know, unless he gets old overnight and his chin just disappears from the shots that we've seen him take over time, especially, this is many years ago now, but some of the flush shots he took from Triple G and he just stood there.
Right.
Just Charlo hit like that. I don't think so. Not from what we've seen so far. And like you said, I don't think we've ever really seen, and I'm not saying he can't do it, we've never really seen Jermell have to box from the outside. You know, so far, you know, if you look at the fights when he fought Castaño, he managed to really to get Castaño to brawl. Like you said, you know, I think, the fact that he managed to beat him the second time around is, you know, he managed just to catch Castaño and bring him into his type of fight, you know, bring him more into like that type of brawl. Same for, you know, when he fought someone like Rosario, Tony Harrison.
Tony Harrison, too. I mean, Tony Harrison in that first fight, you know, really, he was just boxing him.
Yeah, I mean, I remember talking about that at the time. You know, Harrison kind of like stood him on his head, I thought, the first time around. And then the second time around, Tony just did that stupid thing where he kind of like text rounds off. And then he was up against the ropes, if I remember rightly, and Charlo just caught him. And then that was all that she wrote. And that's not something you're going to get from Canelo. You know, he's a super professional. He doesn't really take rounds off or anything like that. He's always dialed in. And I don't think that we've seen a style from Charlo so far that would beat Canelo. But I'm not saying he doesn't have it. Maybe he's just been in fights where he's never needed to show it.
Exactly. And, you know, and if anybody's going to get that out of you, it's going to be somebody on the biggest stage like Canelo Alvarez. That's the thing. And Jermell Charlo, obviously we can see that the Charlo brothers, they're very emotional guys in terms of, you know, behavior and you know, interviews and just kind of, you know, reacting to things, you know, it kind of really easily affects them, in terms of skin thickness. So I don't know, maybe if Canelo catches Charlo with a good shot, Charlo maybe kind of, you know, he kind of throws his plan out the window, or he starts getting a little bit more like upset and starts to make some mistakes. I mean, that, you know, obviously that happens in fighting, especially in boxing. I think Jermell, in comparison to his brother being in this fight, I think Jermell is the more talented fighter, and I think he will put up a better competitive fight than his brother at 160 pounds in Jermall. But yeah, I just think that, you know, you're on the big stage. Eventually, you know, if you get the opportunity, you get to the big stage like these guys against right now a Canelo Alvarez, or back in the day with a Floyd, an Oscar De La Hoya, a Chavez, a Pacquiao, a Mike Tyson, and all of that. You know, can you, what is Mayweather? What did he always used to say? He's like, oh yeah, you can be the best fighter in the gym, but I'm the best fighter under the lights. You know, that's real. That is real. Like, and I know Charlo's been in some big fights and, you know, in front of big crowds on Showtime and all that. But when you level up to the highest level you can get in fighting like this, fighting the cash cow, the king of the sport, it is a different environment. You can feel the environment. It's a different feeling. So, yeah, I agree with you. I think Canelo stops him. I think he stops him within, I think he stops him within 10. And it's also because, like, I mean, you did mention that Canelo doesn't take rounds off. You're right. In a sense, I could agree with that. I can see why you said that, but it's also like Canelo does take a couple rounds to dissect you. It's not that he's like really taking the round off. He's still throwing, but he's trying to like pretty much measure where you're coming from in those first couple rounds, and sometimes he just takes a little bit too long, kind of like a Lomachenko. So you know, it is he gonna take 2 or 3 rounds again to try to dissect Charlo to see where he's coming from, and then turn it on in rounds 4, 5 through 12 possibly? I mean, because that's usually his MO, what Canelo's been doing for quite a few years against opponents. But Yeah, I think within 10, I think Canelo stops him. But I think Charlo's going to go for it. I think Charlo, because, you know, like I said, they're him and his brother, they're both emotional guys wearing, like, their heart on their sleeve. I think he's going to really go for it, especially if he's backed into a corner. He's a fighter. Like, he'll brawl and he'll give it all he got. So I do give that to him. So, but it's an intriguing matchup. It really is. But I think, like you mentioned, the size difference, even though when they were standing face to face and all that, Canelo's been fighting the bigger guys for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years now, or whatever it's been, 3 years, 4 years or whatever it's been, between 168 and 175, you know, and Charlo's been fighting guys at 154 and moving up 14 pounds. That's pretty big. So, you know, I agree with you. I think we both are on the same page here. It just depends on, I'm not sure what you said in terms of rounds, but I said within 10.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think towards the back end, like round 10, yeah, round 9, 10 or 11, I think he just wears him down. And, you know, we've never really seen Charlo so far have to go through adversity. And I just wonder, like, how he's going to, like you said, you know, they do wear the heart on the sleeve. And I just wonder how, is he going to rise to the occasion, or is he going to wilt, you know, because they're very, very emotional guys, both of them. So that's going to be interesting. But before we move on, there's two things I wanted to throw to you is, with the three fights for PBC, are we going to see Charlo, the other Charlo, and then Benavidez? And then also, Canelo's didn't fight Mexican Independence Day weekend. And Dana White came out saying that show was successful. And now, regardless of whoever's fighting, UFC are going to go that weekend every year.
Oh, yeah, I heard him say that. And I mean, let's see if he does. Like, I mean, because I feel like Canelo and, you know, whoever he's with at the time, is going to, I don't think Canelo's going to, next year, he's going to try to get that date. I think he's going to be like, no, I'm going to get that date. Like, he's going to give it a shot, but we'll see. But in terms of what you just said about Charlo, kind of, you know, how we talked about how he wears the hearts on his sleeve, him and his brother, I do expect him, unless he just gets really knocked out with that one shot and just doesn't get up, like, if he's hurt or if he's, like, really just losing the fight or something, he's the type of fighter that will really just go for it. You know, he'll just brawl out and try to go for it. Like, okay, I'm losing the fight or I'm hurt, I'm just going to throw everything I got at him. You know, what do I got to lose? I'm already losing the fight, or I can feel that I'm hurt. I feel like Charlo is that type of fighter. You know, he'll go for it. So I think that's what also makes this fight very intriguing. And you know, it's interesting when you see, it's kind of, we talked about Conor Benn, Chris Eubank Jr. Conor Benn was essentially moving up in weight. I know it was like a catch weight, I believe. But it is interesting, even though it is a smaller fighter essentially going up in weight to fight a bigger fighter in a way, if you want to categorize it like that. But, you know, undisputed champion at that weight versus another undisputed champion, marketing wise, PR wise, for Showtime, I'm sure they're loving it. But yeah, I think we agree. Canelo within 10, I think is our prediction, a pretty safe prediction. And then Dana White, you know, he's said things in the past before, and he's changed his mind. So, you know, let's see if he really goes for Mexican Independence Day weekend next year. Let's see if he really does it. Because, you know, he says one thing, and then if, you know, next year, if he doesn't have that date or he doesn't do that weekend, he could be like, you know, there was just some logistical things that didn't work out for the day, so we couldn't do it. But it's not that we were going to do it. You know, we were going to do it. There was just stuff behind the scenes scheduling wise that we couldn't coordinate fast enough to secure the date. I feel like that's what's going to be, you know, but Canelo, I think is definitely going to try to get that weekend back. Cause when's the last time a boxing has lost Mexican Independence Day weekend for a big event? You know, this is the first time in how many years? Think about it.
The need to do Canelo Benavidez.
Yeah, I can see that maybe next year. You know, but we'll see. I mean, if Canelo beats Jermell, maybe he might want to fight Jermall, and then they could sell it from a marketing standpoint, like, I'll let his brother try to avenge it. I mean, you never know. In the co-main event of this Showtime pay-per-view card, Yordanis Ugas, former welterweight world champion, 27-5, goes up against Mario Barrios, 27-2. This is for the WBC interim welterweight championship of the world. What do you think about this fight?
Interesting fight. They seem to love Barrios because he gets title shot after title shot. You know, he came in, fought Gervonta Davis, lost to him, fought Keith Thurman, lost to him, came back and fought Giovanni Santiago, won that by eighth round TKO. Boom, straight back in for a WBC interim world title shot. So, yeah, PBC like him. I'm guessing he must be popular or he puts bums on seats or something like that. But I think Ugas, if Ugas still has it, I think he should be able to, you know, box Barrios pretty easily and, you know, get the victory. Barrios really is more of a come forward type of slugger. And he really used to, when he was at 140, he was kind of more dangerous because he was naturally the bigger guy and could kind of bully people. But ever since kind of moving up to like 147, I don't see him being as good. But should be an interesting fight. You know, how old is Ugas now?
That's probably 35, 36.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not on his box rec. So he must, I would say he's around 35, 36. You know, last time out, lost to Spence in April.
Well, his eye was pretty messed up too.
Yeah, and I mean, that was over a year ago. That was April 2022. So we'll just see, you know, has he got old overnight? You know, he's only had, you know, one fight in 2021 against Manny Pacquiao, one fight in 2022. So this would be his third fight.
Well, I mean, that's par for the course for a lot of PBC fighters the last several years, isn't it? Are we really surprised, you know?
Yeah.
But I think I agree with you. I think Ugas takes this. I think he just, the Cuban boxing technique, I think, comes out. Even though he is older, I just think Barrios isn't, you know, he's getting rewarded a lot, you know, for PBC, but I don't think he's the, I just think Ugas is still the superb, more superb, talented fighter. So, yeah. Either way, it's an intriguing matchup. You know, both are kind of at a crossroads in their careers. So, you know, let's see how it goes this weekend. Another fight on the card, which is actually a really good card. I'm really looking forward to this one. Jesus Ramos, 20-0, goes up against Erickson Lubin, 25-2. What do you think about this matchup?
This whole card is pretty good. We actually are previewing quite a lot of the fights because this whole card is pretty stacked. You're actually getting your money's worth for this one. You know, normally when you get a pay-per-view, like 90% of the money is kind of going to the main event and the rest of it is kind of like hit and miss, but this card is pretty good. I don't know whether it's harsh to say you've got a prospect in Ramos fighting potentially a gatekeeper now in Lubin. That might be a little bit harsh, but...
You think so? Because Lubin's, what, 20, late 20s, I think?
Yeah, but you know, it's every time he fought Charlo, got stopped by Charlo.
I think he was too young in his career and his age when he fought Charlo, because he fought Charlo here in L.A. at the Galen Center at the USC. And I get it, you know, Lubin was still rising, but like I think he fought Charlo too young at that point. But that's just me.
Yeah, but he was 21. He was 21 at the time, 6 years ago.
Yeah, so yeah,
he just got caught early on, didn't he?
I still think this is an interesting matchup. I mean, Lubin, he lost to the Tower of Inferno, didn't he?
Yeah, when his face was all bashed in.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that was? Speaking of Sebastian Fundura, I wonder when he's going to come back. But I think this might be the most competitive matchup of the card of the whole night. I honestly have a feeling it might be.
Yeah, looking at the card, yeah. I mean, it's a pick'em because you got Ramos, who's really kind of like stepping up for the first time against Lubin, who's, you know, still only 27, but he's got a lot of experience, you know, fighting Charlo, Ishii Smith, Gallimore, Terrell Geisha, Jason Rosario, Sebastian Fundora, Luis Arias.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been in there with a whole host of people. You know, I might have just changed my pick there. I was going to go Ramos, but after just naming all those people, you can't buy that experience. So it's...
Yeah, and he's still young. He's still... Yeah. He's what, 27? Like you said, he's in his late 20s. So...
I'm going to change it, actually. I just convinced myself.
Oh, you know what? I think this is a... Is this a first? Is this a first in history in the 5-year life cycle of the Last Round Podcast that you're changing your pick in the middle? You picked one and then you're changing it? I don't know if you've ever done this. Have you? I don't know. I really don't.
I don't think so. Normally I'll just get set, but then looking at that, I think I'm going to go Lubin for a Lubin points now.
I was going to go Lubin.
I think Lubin points, because if you look at Ramos's record, obviously the one that stands out is Brian Mendoza. And Brian Mendoza just knocked out, you know, the Towering Inferno, Sebastian Fundora. And apart from that, most of the people that, you know, Ramos has fought have kind of been more of your gimme type people. You know, he got in there and obviously knocked out Joseph Spencer. I was never high on Spencer, who the PBC were pushing.
Right.
So, yeah, the only one that really stands out to me is Mendoza. So I think going off that, I'm going to go with someone like Lubin, because he's been in there, seen it, done it. And, you know, if he's still got that mentality where he thinks he can win and he still wants to, you know, come again, I think he should be able to take it. Because I think we've said a few times, if you rewind, Lubin was a hot prospect.
Right. Yeah. But that's why I wanted to, you know, make sure you think about your pick, because I was thinking Lubin from the beginning. I think I like Ramos. It's not that I'm counting Ramos out. I just think that Lubin, based on his resume with opponents, I'm edging it to him. But it is a competitive fight matchup, and like I said, I'm repeating again that it might be the most competitive fight of the night. So we will see. Also on the card, a heavyweight match of Frank Sanchez, 22-0, who fights with the Canelo camp. He had left them and then he went back. It was pretty quick. It was a very short-lived departure from the Eddie Reynoso camp. Goes up against Scott Alexander, 17-5-2. What do you think about this matchup?
Easy work. Scott Alexander's pretty much just a paid sparring partner. For most people, he just does the rounds in LA. I've been to gyms where he's been in there with, you know, Gerald Washington and people like that. And I think that's pretty much how he boxes, to be honest with you. He kind of just comes in and just kind of gets his money, goes through like the routine and, you know, gets out of there. It's kind of interesting that, you know, this was initially supposed to be Frank Sanchez, Chris Arreola. So I'm not too sure what happened on that. I'll have to speak to you know, the guys on Arreola's team, you know, next time we see them and see why that didn't materialize. But it's kind of a really easy gimme fight for Sanchez. I'd be surprised if Scott Alexander managed to spring a victory.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm giving it to Frank Sanchez here. As I mentioned earlier, he did leave. He left with Ryan Garcia when Ryan Garcia left the Canelo camp. And then within a couple months, it was pretty quick. He ended up returning to Eddie Reynoso and Canelo's camp. I think he realized, like, I think that wasn't the best decision for my career, and he returned. So I think he did return, but like, is he being trained by Eddie Reynoso?
I believe so, yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think him returning is definitely the better trajectory for his career.
Scott Alexander fought Zili Zhang last year, lost by first round KO.
Oh, are you surprised about that from what we talked about earlier in the last two fights with Joe Joyce? I don't think so. I'm not really that surprised. Also on the card, the Nail returns. Alexander Gvozdik, 19-1. It feels like he's been around for a long time. Goes up against Isaac Rodriguez, 28-4. What do you think about this matchup and the Nail coming back?
It should be interesting. It should be interesting to see, you know, he's from his return, he's been pretty busy. You know, they're getting him out there, you know, a lot. He's fought, he had that comeback fight against Obando and then Bolotniks. And then, you know, he's fighting again on another Canelo undercard, you know, obviously since his link up with Reynoso. So it's going to be interesting. I think Rodriguez seems to either win by knockout or lose by knockout. 28 wins, 22 by knockout, 4 losses, 3 by knockout. So it's going to be interesting. Obviously, he's heavy-handed, a 38-year-old coming from Brazil. So it should be an interesting matchup. But I think from what we've seen so far, I think the Nail takes it. If you look at Rodriguez's resume so far, most of them have been, you know, like in Brazil and stuff like that. Every time he's come over, he lost to Damon Nicholson by 6-round KO. He's not really a known puncher, so I think the nail probably starts off slowly, looks at him, works him out, and I think he'll stop him round 8 or 9.
The nail. Running off the card, Elijah Garcia, 15-0, goes up against Jose Armando Resendez, who's 14-1, and then Terrell Geisha, 23-3-1, goes up against Keandre Leatherwood, 23-8-1. I thought that was the same record, but it's not. And then making his debut, at least in the Las Vegas area, and with the backing of Floyd Mayweather, Carmel Moton, I hope I said that right, is making his, as I mentioned, his professional debut against Ezekiel Flores, 4-0. Moton is an 18-time national amateur champion, as I mentioned, he has the support of Floyd Mayweather, and I believe he lives in the Las Vegas area. He's been around the Mayweather gym, and you know, I think he's known within the circles there in the Las Vegas boxing circle. 18-time national amateur champion. What do you think about that? Do you think obviously we can play the guessing game like we had before with fighters, but having the pedigree like that, you know, kind of shows that you're pretty serious, right?
Yeah, I mean, just turning pro at 17 and then getting in there with somebody that's 4-0 with 3 knockouts, who trains out of the same gym as Leo Santa Cruz, it shows that he means business, right? You know, he's not getting in there with somebody with, like, you know, 2 wins and 18 losses like most people turning pro. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what he does. I mean, someone like Floyd Mayweather in the background is obviously going to draw a lot of attention to him. Let's just hope, you know, he's good enough and he's mature enough to handle that, because he's going to get a lot of praise, but he's also going to get a lot of criticism at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It comes with the territory. And also this upcoming weekend as well, from the Wembley Arena in London on DAZN, Jaya Pattaya, undefeated at 22-0, goes up against Jordan Thompson, 15-0. A battle of the undefeateds. This is for the IBF Cruiserweight Championship of the World. What do you think about this IBF Championship matchup?
It should be an interesting matchup. You know, it looked like, you know, Opataya couldn't really find someone to fight. You know, Jordan Thompson got offered it, stepped in. It's going to be interesting, because this is the sort of fight where you can see just like, someone like Thompson kind of just surprisingly gets the fight and then ends up, you know, taking the victory. But, you know, Opataya, you know, beat Breedis Prescott to win it. This obviously shows how good he is. So it's going to be an interesting matchup, I think, just to get in there and see, you know, what Jordan Thompson can do as a last-minute opponent. But, you know, after this, I think we'll hopefully see, you know, Opataya in there with some, you know, some bigger names. Let's see if we can get some like unifications and stuff like that done later down the line. Because it's been a little bit stagnant, you know, that division. And I know that they're trying to get a rematch. I know that, I think Kala Sowlander did an interview and said that, you know, Breedis Prescott's going to be there and he's going to call out the winner and stuff like that. So, you know, is he going to end up, you know, just coming back into it and, you know, taking over again and just kind of slowing down that division? So we'll see. I mean, I'm gonna go Opataya for the win. That performance against, you know, Prescott just shows, you know, what how good that he is, and I think it's a big step up for someone like Jordan Thompson.
I agree with that. I think Opataya has the slight edge here and ends up pulling out the victory. A news and notes section of this week's episode of The Last Round, and some unfortunate news for the boxing world. Boxing trainer Diego Arrua passed away this past weekend in Tijuana, Mexico, following a heart attack that was suffered during his wife's, Sabrina Perez's, matchup against Sky Nicholson, according to the WBC president, Mauricio Suleiman, when he said on X, formerly known as Twitter. Diego Arrua was 58 years old, and he collapsed between rounds 9 and 10 of the bout. So this was actually during the matchup, because I think he was the trainer of his wife. So it was during the actual fight, which was on DAZN, a Matchroom boxing card. you know, it's unfortunate. You know, it's unfortunate that it happened, and it's unfortunate how it happened and when it happened. Like, this was just, you know, a combination, a hurricane of bad circumstances, of bad news for the entire situation. You know, it you train your wife, your significant other during the fight, and as she's in there, you know, trying to beat somebody else with her fist, you're in the middle of the fight. You know, you kind of, you suffer a medical emergency and it doesn't work out. You know, it's very unfortunate. It's very unfortunate. I don't know when's the last time. Have you ever heard of something like this happen? I'm sure there has, but like, have we ever talked about this on any past shows of something happening during the fight? Like, during an actual fight? I'm sure there's been stuff during events, but during the actual fight?
I don't think so. Not to, like, you know, the corner team or anything like that. No, not that jumps out with me. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I can't think of anything. I mean, we could be wrong, but yeah, it's obviously, we send the best wishes to his family, and then Sabrina Perez and her team. Yeah, just unfortunate all around. So, you know, everybody here at the Last Round definitely sends the best wishes to the family and friends out there of trainer Diego Arrua, who passed away at the age of 58. And then also in some reported news, David Benavidez is reportedly, you know, possibly defending. You know, obviously sometimes we see the reports, they don't materialize. But there seems to be news indicating that he's going to defend his interim WBC super middleweight title against Demetrius Andrade sometime at the end of November on a Showtime pay-per-view card. I mean, this is probably the best matchup that you can pick, not just for Benavidez, but obviously for Andrade, but mostly for Benavidez, right? Especially if he's trying to wait out to get the Canelo sweepstakes. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think it's a stylistic nightmare for Benavidez. You know, he's kind of likes to come forward and kind of just like a juggernaut, I guess. He's kind of comes straight forward, beats you up, just kind of like beats you to a pulp constantly, pressure, pressure, pressure. And he's normally the bigger, stronger man, you know, because he's pretty big for the super middleweight division. Could probably end up finishing up at like a light heavy or even a cruiserweight eventually later down the line. To fight someone who's a slick boxer like Andrade, that's just, stylistically, I think it's going to be a nightmare for him. So all props to him, you know, definitely. You know, if he gets in there with Andrade and actually manages to get the win, then yeah, that's...
Just imagine if Andrade pulls it off. Like you said, he has that different style and it's a little bit, it's hard to kind of really get in there and find him. Because it's just an interesting style, but
he's got the same problem that we were talking about earlier in Richardson Hitchens,
right?
He's very good. What is boxing? You know, hit and don't get hit, and that's essentially what they both did.
But Benavidez is definitely a stalker.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. He walks you down, and he eventually, you know, he finds you. You know, so I mean, do you think Andre's going to be able to sustain that type of fighting style from somebody like Benavidez for 12 rounds?
That's the problem, isn't it? When you watch Andrade, he kind of, for the first few rounds, he racks up, you know, round after round after round, and then he just kind of goes missing. Because how many times have we seen Andrade in fights where, you know, he's had the opponent like either down or against the ropes and he looks like he could be able to jump on him? Then his dad's just like, hey, no, don't take the risk. You know, we're winning. Don't jump in there. Don't leave yourself open. And that's the negative thing that I think we've all said about him is, you know, he doesn't have that kind of like bloodlust where like someone like a Joshua, like a Canelo, like when they see someone's injured, they just jump on him and that's it. Like they're just going to get him out of there. Andrade doesn't, constantly plays it safe. You know, if he's 6, 7, 8 rounds up, you can see him. He's just going to probably dance for the last 4, you know?
Yeah.
He's like, well, what, you know, I just want the W. I don't care about putting on a show and entertaining you guys. So, yeah, I mean, all props to Benavidez. That would be a great fight to watch because just stylistically, you know, who can win the chess match? You know, can he catch him? And is he good enough to dance around and negate him for 12 rounds?
Right. Yeah. And Andrade finally has, you know, a significant opponent that he's been trying to get for years. So, you know, let's see how it works out. But yeah, I think this is the best opponent on the market right now, in the available market for Benavidez. So, you know, I'll give it to him because, you know, he's obviously trying to wait for a Canelo, and, you know, Triple G's out, you know, going to fight him, and, you know, all these other big guys and stuff like that, Charlo and all that. So he's the best one on the market, available on the market. And if this finalizes after these reports we've been seeing, you know, I'll give credit. But it'll be, like you said, it's going to be very interesting to see how it unfolds, but just based on both of their styles. And then also, Emmanuel Navarrete has been granted super champion status by the WBO at 130 pounds, which closely followed the same ruling in favor of Teofimo Lopez at 140 pounds. The WBO said because he's very good, he's a star, he fights on ESPN. Were those actually reasons? Those were actually reasons they gave?
Yeah, this was taken from ESPN's website.
Wow, that's very interesting. You know, I'm sure people are going to remember those words. A reminder that this is the WBO, not the WBA, who have for years had the words super world and world champion in their own confusion debacle. And they said a couple of years ago that they would take away the regular champion and all that, but it's still kind of there. So I don't know. It's all these alphabet. You know, we keep talking about this. Obviously, we're a boxing podcast. We're going to touch on it, but it's the alphabet soup. But the WBO could potentially go in that direction. But in this case, the super champion status basically amounts to granting a fighter extra leeway in terms of mandatory defense orders and the ability to be considered a mandatory challenger if moving up or down in weight. It's essentially, if they like your promoter, if they get along with your promoter, your broadcaster, and then if you make a decent amount of financial, return in general, that's pretty much how you get the status, right? Am I wrong?
Yeah, you put bums in seats, they'll let you do what you want. If you can move up and down in weight, just fight for championships and stuff like that, where at times it's good, right? You know, we like it because if we've got a really cool champion at 160 and he can go up to 168 and fight somebody, we love it. You know, it's all good. I'm all for that. But I just don't find it strange at times when they just, you know, hand them out. You know, I'd like to have seen Teofimo Lopez have at least a couple more fights at 140. You know, he came in, beat Josh Taylor, and then boom, they upgraded him to, what is it, super champion? Is that what they said?
Yeah. I mean, are we really surprised? I mean, WBO no. Top rank. We've seen it time and time again. So, you know, it is what it is. It's boxing at its finest, I guess, if you want to describe it like that. But once again, guys, we appreciate you guys listening to this week's episode of the Last Round podcast. And before we sign off for the week, Mike, go ahead and let them know where they can find us and follow us.
We are at The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter. Be sure to join us next week. We'll be previewing Lee Wood against Josh Warrington and Gilberto Ramirez against Joe Smith Jr.
And obviously reacting to Canelo and Charlo's fight this weekend, which is a, you know, Canelo fight, big star returning to the ring. So for once again, for my co-host Michael Shepherd, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round Podcast.